Please welcome the Honourable Melissa Park.
Good evening, everyone. It's wonderful to see so many people here to hear about Yemen. Now, I know we have Hassan here who actually is Yemeni. He's moved to Australia 3 years ago, married an Australian. So it's wonderful to have a Yemeni person here, and I may have to refer to him for some answers to questions. Now, I wanted to show a brief video, so I'm just going to... It's only a four-minute video. Okay, powerful film. We played that just before we did our media conference in September at the Human Rights Council to present our second report. I think it's a good idea to say a few words about Yemen itself to begin with. It's a country with a long and rich history. Think Queen of Sheba, the spice route, sitting on the mouth of the Red Sea. It has for centuries been a centre for trade. Sana'a, the capital, is one of the oldest inhabited cities of the world. Is that okay? Okay. And contains in the old city of Sana'a, we have a World Heritage Site. How many of people here have been to Yemen? Yeah, so a few of you. And the Sana'a is extraordinarily beautiful. You have mud brick buildings with the plaster designs on the outside, and all of the windows are stained glass windows with different colours and patterns. And at night time when it's lit up, it's just so beautiful. Okay. There are four UNESCO World Heritage Areas in Yemen, including the ancient city of Zabid, where fighting is likely to be taking place as we speak, and the incredible island of Socotra, with its unique flora and fauna. These are pictures of Socotra. All right. Now, Yemen is located at the south of the Arabian Peninsula. It is with Saudi Arabia to the north, Oman to the east, the Red Sea to the west, the Gulf of Aden to the south. It's a very strategic location just opposite the Horn of Africa. And as I mentioned, the capital is Sana'a in the northwest Yemen. I don't have a stick to point with, but you see Sana'a over there? Now, Yemen's governance has always involved competing tribal, regional, religious and political interests, and foreign powers have often involved themselves in Yemen due to its strategic location. In the early 20th century, Yemen was divided between the Ottoman and British empires, with the southern part of Yemen around Aden. Right at the bottom of the map there is Aden. Being a British protectorate until 1967. The modern state of Yemen was formed in 1990. Now, there's obviously a lot that can be said about Yemen's history, but I'm going to fast forward to 2011, the Arab Spring. In 2011, there was an uprising against the 33-year rule of President Ali Abdullah Saleh. There was a deal brokered by the Gulf Cooperation Council, whereby Saleh handed power over to his then Vice President Hadi in exchange for immunity from prosecution. There was then a two-year national dialogue process as part of the transition. At the end of that national dialogue process in 2014, conflict escalated between pro-Hadi government forces on the one hand and the Houthis, a Shia religious and political armed movement, together with armed forces loyal to former President Saleh, And the conflict was around, there are a number of theories about what led to the conflict, but we usually say that it was around, at the end of the National Dialogue process, a conflict around power-sharing arrangements and a draft constitution. In September 2014, the Houthi Salah forces took control of the capital, Sana'a. And the Houthi and Salah forces fought together then until December 2017, when former President Salah announced that he would be willing to talk to the Saudis, and then he was subsequently killed by the Houthis, who called him a traitor. But going back to September 2014, when they first took control of the capital, President Hadi fled from Sana'a down to Aden and then relocated to Riyadh. In March 2015, he requested military assistance from Saudi Arabia and other countries to defeat the Houthis. The Saudi Arabia-led coalition includes the United Arab Emirates as its main coalition partner and a number of other countries, including Jordan, Kuwait, Egypt, Sudan. But the conflict has mostly involved Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, and there are some Sudanese forces in Yemen as well. The US, the UK and France, among other states, support the Saudi-led coalition by supplying weapons and providing ships to patrol the Red Sea and the Gulf. The United States has been involved in providing a significant amount of advice and assistance to the coalition, including mid-air refueling of coalition jets, logistical support, and intelligence sharing. It's fair to say that if the US were to withdraw its support, the conflict would be over. The airstrikes in the north of Yemen have mainly been carried out by the Saudis, while the United Arab Emirates has until recently had control of naval forces and many armed groups on the ground in the south. The south has been effectively under the control of the United Arab Emirates throughout the war, with Hadi government officials and ministers informing our group of experts that they had no effective control over the south and that the Emirates were aiding the southern secessionists. Now, that has changed recently, just as recently as the 5th of November, as a result of what's been called the Riyadh Agreement, under which the United Arab Emirates says it will complete its withdrawal from Yemen and transfer its authority over the many security forces it controls in the south to Saudi Arabia. And both the Yemeni government and the Southern Secessionist Council, who have recently been fighting each other, they've also agreed to hand over control of the government to Saudi Arabia. Now, this is actually an extraordinary development because you've got people who have denounced the Houthis as Iranian proxies themselves signing over the country's sovereignty and their own legitimacy and authority to a foreign power. And we'll see in the coming months how this plays out. There have been some, you know, recent developments in the last few days that indicate that there are some movements on a peace process. So we'll be continuing to watch that. Now, the terms north and south are used quite loosely. The Houthis control around 20% of the Yemeni territory in the northwest of the country, where about 80% of the population live, while the pro-government forces control around 80% of the Yemeni territory in the south and the east, where about 20% of the population live. The conflict has taken an extremely high toll on civilians from the beginning, with no party to the conflict having any regard for the protection of civilians. The former High Commissioner for Human Rights repeatedly requested the establishment of an independent international mechanism to investigate the many, many allegations of human rights violations. Finally, despite resistance from many countries, including parties to the conflict, In September 2017, the Human Rights Council agreed to establish the Group of Eminent Experts, or the GEE, to examine violations of international law. In December 2017, the High Commissioner appointed Kamal Jandoubi from Tunisia as the chair, Professor Charles Garraway from the UK, and myself as the experts, and we are supported by a secretariat of full-time UN staff based in Beirut. Now, the group submitted its first report to the Human Rights Council in September last year and its second report in September this year. There were a lot of obstacles to our work, including budgetary, security, time taken to obtain visas and permissions from parties to the conflict, UN bureaucracy. But the experts and our teams of investigators managed to visit Yemen a number of times in the first year of investigation, including to Aden, Sana'a, Sada and Hodeidah. Unfortunately, due to the ongoing fighting, the GEE was not able to visit the strategically important city of Taiz. Taiz has been one of the main centres of battle throughout the conflict. In our second year of investigations, we were not allowed by the Saudi-led coalition into Yemen at all. Just to give you a bit of a flavour of the place, I wanted to describe one of the visits to Yemen in March last year. Firstly, all of our movements had to be coordinated in advance with the Saudi-led coalition. We initially flew from Djibouti in Africa to Aden. This is the port of Aden. When we got out of the plane, we were then taken in armoured vehicles and escorted by heavily armed military personnel wherever we went. In the late afternoons, after our meetings were finished, we would be taken to the port and put on a ship that moved out of Aden Harbour at sunset in order to spend the night in Somali pirate-infested waters, which was considered safer than being in Aden overnight, due to the presence of Al-Qaeda and IS in Aden. Al-Qaeda has its biggest branch in Yemen. And IS operates in Yemen too, but it's much smaller, than Al-Qaeda. And Al-Qaeda and IS have they've operated like free radicals in the conflict, fighting just about everyone and complicating the situation enormously. And quite separate to the conflict in Yemen, the US is engaged in drone strikes as part of its counter-terrorism operations, and unfortunately the strikes have caused a number of civilian deaths, and President Trump has created a great deal of concern earlier this year when he stopped the public reporting of civilian deaths in Yemen from US drone strikes. It was surreal being on a ship sailing out of Aden Harbour among what can only be described as ghost ships, ships that had been abandoned when the war started and are rusting away in the harbour. And speaking of which, there is an oil tanker containing 1.1 million barrels of oil rusting away at Ras Isla Port on the Red Sea. It's had no maintenance since 2015. A spill from this tanker would involve more than four times the amount of oil released in the 1989 Exxon Valdez oil spill. It's a potential looming environmental catastrophe on the Red Sea, which is a very sensitive marine system. Meanwhile, the parties to the conflict are arguing over who owns the oil, and they won't allow the UN to deal with the situation. Anyway, so back to the ship. Early each morning, the ship would sail back to the port and we would resume our meetings and visits to particular sites. We especially wanted to speak to the Emirati forces concerning their detention centres. However, they refused to speak to us. The reason we wanted to speak to the Emiratis was because we'd received many allegations of arbitrary detention, torture, and sexual violence inside detention centres managed by them or the Yemeni security forces under Emirati control. This is an extract from last year's report, which described how several hundred African migrants were detained in a detention facility in Aden and were subjected to regular torture and rape. Soldiers would select women and boys, detainees at random, and take them to a room with beds in it where the rapes would be carried out. There was reported to be a noose hanging from the ceiling. Detainees were given the choice to submit to the rape or hang themselves. Yeah, okay. On the last night, the ship sailed all the way back to Djibouti, where we again went to the airport and got the one humanitarian flight allowed by the Saudis per day to the Yemeni capital, Sana'a. In Sana'a, we found that, unlike in the south of Yemen, where the legitimate government of Yemen had no control, the Houthis were very much in control in the north. And although the Houthis are not loved by most of the population in the north, the Saudi-led coalition are hated even more due to the death and destruction rained upon them by the coalition airstrikes and the mass starvation caused by the coalition blockades. We were escorted to many sites that had been hit by airstrikes. Here is what's left of the funeral hall that was bombed by the Saudis in 2016. 137 civilians at a funeral were killed and around 700 injured. It's another house that's been it's been destroyed. There's another one. Okay. This was in Sana'a. This is a photo of what's left of this family, two young girls and their father. They lost their home and all the other members of their family and extended family. The father himself had just come out of hospital and he was carrying his hospital papers there with him. And he was explaining how they had absolutely nothing and no means of even getting food. Hardly anyone, only his two daughters left in his family, and he's got his own injuries to contend with. And he said to us, "I don't want to live anymore." And the eldest girl that you see there burst into tears when she heard her father say that. These are ordinary people, and this is happening too. We visited the central hospital in Sana'a and saw children who were on the verge of death from starvation, including this girl whose mother told us her name was Amal, which means hope. The central hospital in Sana'a, I understand, has recently closed down. It was the last functioning hospital, and it ran out of fuel, and because of the blockade, there's no fuel getting in, and electricity infrastructure is being destroyed in Yemen. So the only way hospitals can operate is with generators, and they need fuel for generators, and this hospital had run out of fuel and so was closed down. But when we were there, it was still functioning, barely, and the doctors and nurses who were working there were into their third year of working without any salary at all, and told us how they'd sold all their possessions just to survive, and now they were left with nothing. The non-payment of public sector salaries in the north of Yemen has been one of the most devastating aspects for Yemenis. And as remember, 80% of Yemenis are living in the north, and the government of Yemen moved the central bank from Sana'a to Aden, and at that point they stopped paying salaries to public sector workers in the north, and so teachers and doctors and nurses haven't been paid for years now, and but they're still turning up to work, which is incredible. The doctors and nurses talked to us about the coalition's blockade, which not only prevents food and fuel and medical supplies coming in, but it prevents Yemenis who've been critically injured or suffering from chronic diseases like things like cancer or kidney failure from flying out of Sana'a to seek medical treatment abroad. There have been tens of thousands of Yemenis who have died by simply not being able to get out of Sana'a, including the founder of the Yemeni Red Crescent, who died sadly last year because he couldn't leave Sana'a. Now, just in the last few days, I understand that the Saudis have now agreed to allow flights for ill people to leave Sana'a, and that's a big breakthrough because a lot of deaths have occurred from that restriction. So at night time we stayed in the UN compound in Sana'a. On our last day, when our meetings had finished and we were supposed to be going to the airport, we were told that there would just be a brief detour. We were driven by the Houthis to the presidential palace, which had been bombed by the coalition just 2 weeks earlier. And there were fragments of US weapons clearly visible through the rubble. The weapons are marked with where they were made. And we were then taken to an open field, in the centre of which was a table and chairs. Then a bearded guy drives up on a motorbike, gets off. And he's the guy at the end of the table there with the dagger in his belt, and introduces himself as the leader of the Houthis. He invited us to sit down at the table. We said, well, we didn't have long as we were supposed to be at the airport. We started to hear a jet overhead. Now, there's only one thing that will be flying in Yemeni airspace, and that is a coalition jet. Our security guy opened all the car doors. You can see there the car doors are open. He was having a fit. He said we needed to leave immediately. The Houthi leader said, you only have to put up with this for 5 minutes. We have to put up with it all the time. You can sit with me for a few minutes. So we did sit down at the table and we had our short meeting in that open field with the jet overhead, but it felt a lot longer than the few minutes we were there. And then when we did manage to extricate ourselves and get in the armoured cars, we had a hair-raising, dangerous ride to get to the airport before our flight was leaving, because the UN plane had to leave at the Saudi-appointed time and couldn't wait for us if we were late. So, what did our investigations find? Now, our investigations necessarily have only covered a tiny fraction of violations alleged to have been committed over the 5 years of the conflict. But the evidence that we did manage to collect is devastating, and it's contained in our two official reports and a longer conference room paper, which is a distressing but worthy read. It contains case studies, quotes from victims and families, and detailed analysis of our findings. And if anyone's interested, what I'll do is I'll give the link for the report to the association, and then they can distribute it to anyone who would like to look at it. We found that all of the parties to the conflict in Yemen are responsible for a wide array of human rights violations and violations of international humanitarian law. And some of these violations amount to war crimes. We found that there has been no genuine regard by any of the parties to the conflict for international law or for human life and dignity. Not a single person has been held to account by any of the parties to the conflict for any of the atrocities that have been committed in the 5 years so far. There are no clean hands and no good guys in this conflict. The practical impact of these violations on the lives of ordinary Yemenis has been devastating. Shelling, airstrikes, and snipers hit people going about their daily lives, often without warning, in areas where there's no combat going on, creating the sense that there's no safe place to hide. The airstrikes, as I mentioned, are only being done by the Saudi-led coalition, as the Houthis don't have an air force or any planes. And it's the airstrikes that have caused the most direct civilian casualties. These strikes have struck residential areas, markets, funerals, weddings, detention facilities, fishing boats, medical facilities, despite the prohibition on such attacks against civilians and civilian objects in international law. I just wanted to read out a couple of passages from our conference room paper. This is an incident that happened on the 9th of March this year between 9 and 10 p.m. Three successive weapons dropped from aircraft hit two civilian homes and a farm in Hajar province. Airstrikes had intensified following the Houthi takeover of the area the day before. One witness reported that planes had been bombing and roaming the area for several hours that night. The first airstrike hit a home without causing civilian casualties. Around 1 hour later, a nearby house sheltering a number of families was hit by another airstrike. Seven children and nine women were reportedly killed, and 13 people were injured, including three women and seven children. Having heard the blast of that second strike, which fully destroyed the house, families sheltering in a home nearby ran into an open area at a farm for a fear their house would be next. They were, however, immediately hit by a third airstrike while trying to escape. Eight civilians were killed in the third strike, four women and four children. A 16-year-old girl with a severe physical disability was reportedly injured while trying to escape. She died as a result of her injuries 3 days later in hospital. A witness described to the group of experts how 17 people had fled the second house, which was sheltering five families at the time. He said he was running to join them after they'd taken out the women and children when the airstrike hit the farm. As a plane believed to be conducting reconnaissance continued roaming the areas, he hid and told the group of experts that he could hear the screams for help of those who survived but was too scared to go to them. He described to the group that the men only reached them in the early morning and that he found torn pieces of the children's bodies and blood all over the farm between 10 to 40 metres away from the blast. The group of experts was not able to confirm the existence of any military presence around the house or farm, which was located in a remote village. And then this is an attack on attacks on fishing communities in Yemen. We examined the situation of the fishing communities on the western coast during the fighting around Hodeidah. The community, fishermen were hit by coalition airstrikes and Yemeni armed forces and affiliated UAE-backed groups shelling. Some of them remained disappeared, held incommunicado in Saudi Arabia. This resulted in their livelihoods being severely affected and had negative implications on the situation of their family members who were left behind when fishermen heads of households are killed, injured or disappeared. New incidents that have occurred since 2018 report involve the killing of fishermen by coalition warships in the Red Sea. In these incidents, the boats were reportedly completely destroyed. Most of the examined cases describe efforts made by the fishermen to communicate with the attacking warship or helicopter, either by waving hands, white flags, showing fish, or essentially by having a clearance and authorization from the port authorities acknowledging their legitimate presence in the sea. On the 15th of September last year, a coalition warship launched shells on a fishing boat carrying 19 fishermen from Al-Hodeidah. The fishermen were targeted while they were on a fishing trip in an area near the sea border between Eritrea and Yemen. 18 of the 19 fishermen were killed. The only survivor was rescued by another fishing boat 2 days later and then reached the coast of Al-Hodeidah, where he received medical treatment. The exact circumstances of the killing of the fishermen are not clear, as the only survivor of the incident has disappeared. The group of experts has received information that United Arab Emirates officials attempted to ensure that the only witness, as well as sources and relatives of the killed fishermen, remain silent about the incident. The group of experts found serious problems with the targeting process used by the coalition, in violation of international humanitarian law principles of distinction, proportionality, and precautions. We didn't receive any answers to our questions about how military targets were defined and selected. But the sheer number of civilian casualties raises concerns about the nature and effectiveness of any proportionality assessments conducted and whether any precautionary measures were adopted. And we were concerned also about the use of double tap airstrikes. So that is where you have a strike, and then maybe 15 or so minutes later, you have another strike, which then kills first responders. And that has been, sadly, a feature of this conflict, as I know it has in other conflicts as well. We concluded that there were systemic faults with the targeting process of the coalition, which may constitute potential war crimes. In response to international concern about mounting civilian death toll in Yemen, the coalition, Saudi-led coalition, established in Riyadh the Joint Incidents Assessments Team to assess airstrikes. We assessed the JIAT, as it's known, and found it not to have any independence, transparency, or credibility. In the video, you saw some of the result of the airstrike that occurred on the bus last year, containing 50 young boys at a market, and there were at least 39 boys on that bus were killed. Now, the coalition changed its story several times in the aftermath of that incident, but eventually the JIAT, which is this Joint Incidents Assessments Team, stated that there were four Houthi commanders on the bus, which made it a military target. They conceded that they should not have carried out the airstrike while the bus was at the market, which is a reference to the need for precautions in attack, but they made no reference to the fact that there were 50 children on the bus. That is, they appeared to believe that as long as they were targeting a military object, the attack was lawful, while completely omitting to conduct any proportionality assessment in relation to the likely civilian casualties, particularly children. Accordingly, this attack would probably constitute a war crime. The father of an 11-year-old boy killed in that bus bombing said to us, "I didn't find the body of my son. I was only given his foot, or what might have been his foot, for something symbolic to bury." Now, the civilians, there's nowhere for anybody to go in Yemen to get away from this. People who stay in their homes are liable to be hit by a shell or an airstrike. Those who try to flee their homes, sometimes across active battle lines, are also terribly at risk. They're at risk from targeted airstrikes, and they're also at risk from indiscriminate shelling by all of the parties to the conflict. So just as the deliberate targeting of civilians in an airstrike is a war crime, so is the indiscriminate attack and indiscriminate shelling of an area that's populated, a residential area, because it fails to distinguish between military and civilian objects. Landmines, too, are indiscriminate weapons that kill or injure whoever touches them, and our report found that landmines left by the Houthis have continued to kill and maim people long after battles have subsided. To date, 149 children have been killed and 579 injured from landmines. The Houthis have also employed snipers to terrorise populations. In one case we investigated, a mother had run onto the road to rescue her son, who'd been shot by a sniper, only to be shot by the sniper herself. I was just going to read another extract about the shelling of a port area in Aden by the Houthis. As the fighting drew near, a large number of civilians rushed to the Al-Tawaihi port to flee on boats, as most other escape routes had already come under the control of the Houthi Salah fighters. Dozens of people, including women, children, elderly, and displaced persons, had gathered on the pier that morning. While passengers boarded boats, shells landed near the pier. Two mortar shells landed in the water. A third round landed on a boat loaded with 20 to 30 passengers, and a fourth round impacted the wall of the port and projected shrapnel onto the pier. Witnesses also reported seeing small arms fire into the water. The boat impacted by the shelling caught fire. Some of the passengers of the boat died as a consequence of the shelling. Some were caught in the fire, and others drowned after jumping in the water. Shrapnel from the impact on the pier killed and injured many others. The shelling came from Al Muwala, the direction from which the Houthi Salah fighters had been advancing. While there were reports that some members of the resistance helped the people board boats during that morning, it is clear that the crowd present was principally composed of civilians, including women, children, and elderly persons. All of the parties to the conflict are also actively recruiting children as young as 12 years old, including through force. That too is a war crime. The Saudi-led coalition has also imposed blockades on Yemen, as I mentioned before, preventing or significantly delaying ships carrying food, medicine and fuel from entering Yemen's northern ports. Before the conflict, Yemen was already the poorest country in the Middle East, and it imported 90% of its food, fuel and medicine mainly through the northern ports, including the large port of Hodeidah. So the blockade has had a devastating impact on the population's access to those items. As I mentioned, all the parties have imposed sieges on particular areas and restricted the delivery of humanitarian aid and carried out attacks on hospitals, port infrastructure, water facilities, markets and farmland, that is, objects indispensable to the survival of the population. So 24 million people out of an estimated population of 28 million people. So that's 80% of Yemen's population are in need of humanitarian assistance just to survive, with around 15 million people on the verge of starvation, of famine. This is the world's largest humanitarian crisis, but it is an entirely man-made humanitarian crisis. The Yemeni people are not starving. They are being starved by the parties to the conflict. Last year, a Saudi airstrike destroyed a clearly marked Médecins Sans Frontières cholera treatment centre. Also, both sides of the conflict prevented cholera vaccines from entering Yemen and being distributed for many months. As a result, 460,000 Yemenis in the first half of this year, that's the official number, the unofficial number would be higher, have contracted cholera, including more than 200,000 children, many of whom have died as a result, all unnecessary preventable deaths. There is a climate of fear in Yemen as Yemeni people continue to be arrested and detained arbitrarily, disappeared, subjected to torture and ill treatment, including sexual violence, and in some cases have died in the custody of parties to the conflict or shortly after release. Now this, we've come to this quote now. This is a male survivor of Houthi torture in Sana'a, saying they would hang me fully naked from a hook on the wall, and twice they tied a water bottle to my testicles and filled it with water. This was even more painful than being electrocuted. Another said, the problem is beyond torture. It is the loss of humanity I cannot accept. The Houthis have detained journalists. Well, actually, all sides have detained journalists, human rights defenders, people they perceive to be opposed to them. But the Houthis in particular are persecuting people on the basis of their religious beliefs, particularly people of the Baha'i faith. One Baha'i leader who's been in detention for several years now without due process has been given the death penalty. Many other Baha'is have been arrested and denied access to representation. This is an ideological hatred that the Houthis have, probably learned from Iran, and there is no justification for what they are doing to the Baha'i people and the international, our office and international community has made it very clear that we are watching the situation of the Baha'is and others who are detained, and hopefully nothing terrible will happen to them before the conflict is ended. Of course, in a conflict, it is the most marginalised people who suffer the worst fates, including internally displaced persons. There are at least 3 million internally displaced persons in Yemen, most of them women and children. There are minorities like the Muhammashin community. There are people with disabilities and migrants. Despite Yemen being a war zone, a staggering 85,000 migrants entered Yemen in the first half of this year, endeavouring to get to the Gulf countries to find work. Now, that's the official number. The unofficial number will be much higher, and it gives you some idea of the level of desperation of these people. We also investigated some horrific incidents of rape and extreme torture and murder of members of the marginalised Muhammashin community. The Muhammashin suffer ancestry-based discrimination, much like the Rohingya in Myanmar. And although the Muhammashin, who may have originated in Africa at some time, have been in Yemen for centuries, they're still regarded as outsiders, as servants. As a result, they're not accepted into Yemeni tribes and miss out on any protection and often humanitarian aid, as the tribal system plays a vital role in aid distribution and allocation at the community level, particularly in remote areas. They're confined to living in slums on the outskirts of cities and during the conflict have suffered multiple displacements, often ending up near the front lines. As this fellow said to us, when the war came, it was a death sentence for us. We left our homes forcibly and we reached places that are not our places, where some people could not accept us or rather refused for us to live in their lands temporarily until the war ended and we returned to our homes. This was the tragedy when we felt that we were living in exile inside of our exile while being in our own country. The Muhammashin are also vulnerable to being forcibly recruited into armed groups or to joining such groups in order to earn some money for their families due to their extreme poverty. They receive no training and are sent straight to the front lines. A young man from the Muhammashin community spoke about his brother who died fighting in the conflict. He said, "And my brother said to my mother, 'Mother, pray for me and I will gather some money and make you happy, God willing.' On the day of his funeral, my mother did not see him. Until this day, she is crying." I mentioned the fact that the parties to the conflict are causing an enormous amount of fear to the population by cracking down on any perceived dissent. And they're particularly monitoring activists, journalists, human rights defenders, humanitarian workers, and imposing restrictions on their work. Women activists face punishment from all sides of the conflict. Yemeni society, as you would know, was already deeply patriarchal before the conflict, but the situation has become far worse for women with the conflict and the associated displacement, poverty and indiscriminate violence. The already limited support against violence by the criminal justice system has completely collapsed, and now law enforcement actors pose a direct threat to women's security. The humanitarian crisis has disproportionately affected women and children. Of the 24.1 million people needing humanitarian assistance to survive, 18.2 million women and children. Most households in Yemen are now female-led, with 21% led by girls under 18. The war has forced many negative coping strategies, including sexual exploitation, child labour and child marriage. We received many allegations of gender-based violence committed by all parties to the conflict, but investigation is difficult, particularly for those cases occurring in detention. which seems to be systematic, a systematic approach to detainees now to commit gender-based violence against them, systematic sexual violence. And gender-based violence survivors in Yemen face stigma, shame, and risks of reprisal from family and the wider society. And it's not just women and girls who are affected. The rape of men and boys in detention will also have an ongoing impact upon Yemeni families, communities, and the wider society into the future. There is also now a trend among the parties to the conflict to engage in hostage-taking of women and girls to extort money or force a male relative to surrender. Our group also examined attacks on hospitals, schools, religious sites, and cultural heritage. All of these acts amount to violations of the rights of the Yemeni population, and many of them amount to international crimes. Now, in terms of cultural heritage, I'm not sure if I mentioned that Socotra, the island I showed you earlier, is under the control of the United Arab Emirates. Did I mention that before? No, which has established a military base there, which is very concerning to the Yemeni people. But as we know from other conflicts as well, unfortunately, cultural heritage tends to be one of the first victims of war, and its destruction has a strong impact on the morale of the population. Now, the group of experts has insisted in our reports that there must be accountability for the serious violations and crimes we've found. Where we found information linking specific people to violations or patterns of violations, the names of those individuals have been transmitted to the High Commissioner for Human Rights on a confidential basis for use in the event that an accountability mechanism is established by the international community in the future. So we are a group, we are investigating violations of international law, but we're not a tribunal ourselves. So at some point or another, we hope that there will be a mechanism set up, whether it's like the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia or many of the others that have been established in more recent years. Remains to be seen, but we certainly hope that there will be some process put in place to deal with all of these terrible things. The mandate of our group has been renewed for the second time, and we will continue investigating the kinds of matters that I've talked about tonight. Now, the hostility to our work has meant that this year we've not only not able been able to go to Yemen, but we've also been prevented from going to many other places in the region where we'd hoped to meet with some of the parties and with witnesses and families of victims. And so this has meant a greater reliance on information from other UN agencies and NGOs on the ground in Yemen, as well as having secure forms of telephone internet communications, which is not an easy achievement since there is not great access to the internet in many parts of Yemen. Now, you might be wondering why there's been no global outcry about what's happening in Yemen. There was some attention on the Yemen conflict following the graphic murder of the journalist Jamal Khashoggi inside the Saudi consulate in October last year in Turkey. But that anger at Saudi Arabia seems to have mostly dissipated if photos from this year's G20 and the announcement that Saudi Arabia will host next year's G20 are anything to go by. In part, the lack of attention on Yemen is due to the lack of media coverage. The Saudi-led coalition has impeded the work of international media and human rights organisations by preventing their personnel from using UN flights to North Yemen. This has contributed to the conflict being globally neglected. There's also a lack of attention on this conflict because many powerful Western nations are playing a role in supplying weapons to parties to the conflict. Now, every country in the United Nations is a member of the Geneva, is a party to the Geneva Conventions, under which they have a duty not only to respect international law, but to ensure respect for international law. And that is an active, not a passive requirement. And the responsibility to take measures to ensure respect increases with the level of influence that a specific state has over parties to the conflict. If a state is supplying weapons or other support to a party to the conflict, they have influence. In our last report, we named the most prominent states exercising influence, namely US, UK, Iran, and France. But in fact, all states supplying weapons to the parties have influence, including Australia. Countries such as the UK, France, Canada, and Australia have additional responsibilities arising from being parties to the UN Arms Trade Treaty, which prohibits states transferring weapons if they may be used to commit human rights violations. The Arms Trade Treaty requires states' parties to assess the respect for international law of the importing state. And I think we've demonstrated that there is no respect for international law by parties to the conflict in Yemen. The ATT Arms Trade Treaty also requires greater transparency regarding arms transfers. And I think it's clear that there has been a definite lack of transparency when it comes to Australia's supply of weapons to Saudi Arabia and the UAE. And in some cases, the provision of arms or logistical support could amount to knowingly aiding or assisting in the commission of a violation, thus making the state responsible for the violation also, and individuals in third states may be held criminally responsible for aiding and abetting war crimes. Now, with the number of public reports, including ours, establishing serious violations by parties to the conflict, no third state can claim not to be aware of what is going on. There have also been recent reports of arms diversions, where US weapons have been found in the possession of Al-Qaeda in Yemen. So we recommended that all third states prohibit the authorization of arms transfers and refrain from providing weapons to parties to the conflict because of the prevailing risk that those weapons will be used to commit or facilitate serious violations of international law. Now, I've just been... our group has just been to the US, where we met with members of the Security Council, member states of the Security Council in New York, and also went to Washington to speak before the Congress, the Senate. And it was heartening to note that the US Congress, so that is both houses, necessarily with bipartisan support, has voted a number of times to end US military support to Saudi Arabia and UAE. However, these resolutions have been vetoed by President Trump. Out of the six resolutions that have been vetoed by Trump, four relate to Yemen. It's very clear to us that the continued supply of weapons to parties to the conflict is what is perpetuating the conflict and prolonging the suffering of the Yemeni people. And that's why we've said that the suffering of Yemeni civilians represents a collective failure, both of the parties to the conflict and of the international community. And we've also said that both the parties to the conflict and the international community have a collective responsibility to solve the issue, is to stop the violations, to hold perpetrators to account. We've seen what happens when there's no accountability for war crimes. Parties are emboldened to commit even more violence. And given the virtual stalemate that has occurred in this conflict, that is, the front lines have been more or less static for the entire conflict, so it's clear there'll be no military solution. There is a special envoy in Yemen, Martin Griffiths, who's been leading talks to try to bring about an end to the conflict. And we certainly hope that they will bear fruit, particularly, we've just seen in the last few days the Saudis have finally agreed to allow Sana'a Airport to be open, to take people, sick people out. And they have also agreed to exchanging some prisoners. So that's a good thing. But so far, the peace efforts haven't led to a cessation of hostilities. And we see it as our job to bring these matters to the world's attention. because the international media are prevented from doing so, and because the international community has been inclined to look the other way, and even worse, has continued supplying weapons to parties to the conflict. We want people to understand what the daily horror of life is like for the ordinary Yemeni person. And we would like people to call for and insist upon an end to this bloody war where there are no winners. And I will be happy to take any questions.
Thank you. I'm Jim Baxter. A very thought-provoking talk, thank you. But what worries me with this conflict and others is the participants, to my mind, do not seem to have really any deterrent, the fact that eventually they may be brought before a court. And if they are brought before a court eventually, in the meantime, all this damage is happening. So what is really the way to solve it?
Yes, that's a very good question. The international community has a responsibility to do something about this, and so far it has completely failed in that. It is the international community, and particularly those states that have influence over parties, that need to take action. And unfortunately, I mean, it looks like the US would have already ended its support for the war were it not for that man who's currently the president. Interestingly, when we published our two reports, our two official reports, we included an annex to those reports, which in the first annex was a mapping of the actors in the conflict. It was a factual list of the players, the parties to the conflict, the main individuals in those parties to the conflict. And it was not the confidential list of perpetrators that we gave to the High Commissioner for Human Rights, but it seemed that that was the main thing that was upsetting, in particular, the members of the Saudi-led coalition. In their response to our reports was white hot anger that number one person on the mapping of actors was Mohammed bin Salman, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, and they assumed that this was also what was in our list of perpetrators, but that's confidential, and we've said there's no relationship between the two. The annex is simply a mapping of the actors in the conflict, and he clearly is a very significant part of that Saudi-led coalition. He's leading it. So, you know, we couldn't not mention him. But that just touched a nerve for them, that we would publish a list of parties to the conflict. I hope there will be a mechanism. Unfortunately, most of the members of the Saudi-led coalition are not parties to the International Criminal Court Rome Statute, and it's pretty unlikely that the Security Council would refer this matter to the ICC, given the membership of the permanent members of the Security Council. So we have to look at other ways of ensuring accountability for Yemen, but I guess first thing is that we need the violence to stop, and then we can hopefully introduce some accountability measures as part of the peace process. I'm sorry, I did speak for a long time.
Thanks. Thanks, Melissa. That was truly horrifying. I think you succeeded in in bringing back that terrible story with you. This is not really your remit, but just from the way you describe the complexity of the conflict, I wonder, do you feel, is Yemen a demographically sustainable country? I mean, is the problem that it's poorly defined in terms of tribal boundaries and the like, or do you feel like there's a way that this war could end and then Yemen will be a happy place?
Well, I think the chances of it being a happy place would be greatly increased if foreign powers would butt out, because the Yemenis are very pragmatic people and very good at resolving disputes historically, very capable. But the influence of other nations coming in and meddling has not been helpful. The national dialogue process was facilitated by both the Gulf Cooperation Council and the United Nations, was extremely successful in being a very inclusive process that included all of the parties, all of the great representation of women, of young people, of various sectors of the community, and it's a very good model for what can happen. And in fact, they went through all of the issues that Yemen was grappling with, you know. So there's already a very good base there that can be the basis for going forward into the future. And I think, I mean, it's quite interesting that the government of Yemen and the Southern Transitional Council, which until a few days ago were fighting each other, have now sort of come together. And in fact, it seems that they would be part of a government together. And that's quite incredible. So we really don't know where it's going. We don't. But the Yemeni people themselves are resilient, and they are, can I just say the women are amazing. The women, it's women who've been doing a lot of the protesting in the streets, particularly about detentions in both in the south and the north. And despite lots of harassment and persecution and being detained and beaten and so forth, they keep coming out to call for accountability for what's going on in those detention centres. So I think, you know, involving women is going to be a vital part of going into the future for Yemen. But I have hope that if the war can be stopped, then there can be a good future, inshallah.
What's the prize? What are they fighting for? What's the prize? What's the winner get?
Well, I mean, as with many of these kinds of issues, it's all about power and control over.
It's not oil or diamonds or.
No, I mean the originating dispute. I mean, there've been lots of disputes in Yemen over the years, but. The dispute that arose after the National Dialogue process was about power sharing arrangements and the draft constitution, which, for example, for the Houthis, their concern was that the areas that they were going to have control over had no direct access to the sea. And so that really was a concern for them. But there have been lots of issues. But the problem is that it's been horrendously complicated by other states coming in and putting their bib in. I think if we leave it to the Yemenis with assistance as needed from outside to resolve it, then I think they can do a good job of it themselves.
Yeah, I'm sure lots of people have got their own words to, I guess, summarise what Melissa's talked about tonight. But, yeah, I was just thinking, you know, so distressing, and horrifying and really tragic. And some of those figures that you pointed out, 24 million people, you know, that can't live without humanitarian aid, that's the size of our whole population here in Australia.
Yeah.
And, you know, 3 million people, you said, have been displaced, and that's pretty much the whole of Western Australia. So some really shocking stories, and thank you so much for, you know, bring it back to our group. And, yeah, you really are doing a great job of, you know, exactly what we're trying to do as well. And I know that our committee's been working hard to get you here over the last couple of months, and I can see why it's been hard to track you down, and really want to commend you on behalf of everybody here for the incredible work that you're doing and incredibly risky work as well from the stories that you told us. So, yeah, great commitment there. Doing great things on the international stage, coming especially from a country girl coming from Busselton and Donnybrook, as Ash pointed out, really inspiring. And I guess I just hope on behalf of all of us here that you are looking after yourself as well in this plight, because, yeah, those words that I brought up before, highly emotional. And I think we've all would have been touched here this evening by the work that you're doing. So thank you very much for sharing your very personal stories with us, and all the best for... the rest of the mission that you're on, and if there's anything we can do to help, and I'm sure there's going to be lots more conversations about that at dinner, but yeah, just really wanted to thank you. And our one of our volunteers has very aptly chosen some candles for you to take home as a thank you, and yeah, when you light them, we hope that it's a vigil to the people there, and that there's going to be some glimmer of hope that shines through for everyone on the other side of the world. So thanks very much for bringing it to us.
Thank you so much.